This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The law now, because of the judgment, says that they shouldn't be turned away on account of the fact that they don't have documentation. As simple as that.
That's Anjuli Maestri, senior attorney at the Center for Child Law in South Africa, on a court ruling that schools must educate migrant children even if they don't have the proper documents. Details coming up also. The wife of Lesotho's embattled prime minister has turned herself in to face murder charges. And President Donald Trump added 6 countries to his latest travel ban, 4 of them African. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Malawi's vice president is laying the groundwork for a new presidential campaign after the Constitutional Court annulled the results of last year's election, citing massive irregularities. However, the current president, Peter Mutharika, has rejected the court's ruling and says the call for fresh elections cannot be allowed to stand. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Saulos Chilima contested the May election as presidential candidate for the opposition United Transformation Movement Party. He came third with 20% of the vote, second to Lazarus Chakwera of the opposition Malawi Congress Party, who took 35%. President Peter Mutharika of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party narrowly won by 38%. But according to the Constitutional Court's Monday verdict, Mutharika was not duly elected, largely because of massive and widespread irregularities, including the use of collection fluid on result sheets. The judges ordered a fresh poll within 150 days. Chilima told reporters Wednesday that he is now ready to work with anyone to free the country from what he called the dehumanizing grip of acute poverty.
I remain humble in my ambitions, but firm in my desire to see a new Malawi. I pledge to play any part the people of Malawi give me in this said republic. The practical implementation of the Constitutional Court's decision would necessarily require the concerted efforts of all major political players in this country.
But President Mutharika, who is the first defendant in the case, is appealing the court's verdict. His spokesman told a local radio station on Wednesday that the ruling is a very serious miscarriage of justice and an attempt to circumvent the democratic will of people. Lawyer Frank Mbeta represented Mutharika in the case.
First, let me say that we have instructions from our client to appeal. Right now, I'm not in a position to discuss the grounds of appeal because we are formulating them, but I think probably by tomorrow we'll have... them ready and they will be found with the court.
Morris Muntari is the spokesperson for the opposition Malawi Congress Party.
Appeal case won't change anything as far as we are concerned because we have gone through the judgment and we feel that the judges have done their work very professionally, very objectively, without any bias and any favor at all in terms of justice.
Political analyst Vincent Kondowe says it is not easy to overturn unanimous decisions by constitutional court judges.
And when you look at the evidence, when you look at the magnitude of the irregularities that have been expounded by the constitutional court, I do not think an individual would have the courage to appeal such type of a decision. So for me, I would encourage President Peter Mutharika not to appeal.
Chilima said he will consult his legal team for advice once Mutharika files an appeal against the Constitutional Court verdict. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
President Donald Trump added 6 countries to his latest travel ban, 4 of them African countries. The administration said the move is vital to national security, but critics question the rationale as well as its impact on U.S. relations with the African continent. White House correspondent Patsy Wedikusuwara has the story.
Nigeria is Africa's largest economy and most populous country. It's a U.S. anti-terrorism partner with a large diaspora residing in the United States. It's also among the six countries added to the Trump administration's latest travel ban, along with Eritrea, Myanmar, Kyrgyzstan, Tanzania, and Sudan.
You see what's going on in the world. Our country has to be safe.
The U.S. will stop issuing immigrant visas to Nigerians until the country improves security measures in issuing passports. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Nigeria's foreign minister Tuesday and said he is optimistic.
In the proclamation, President Trump highlighted Nigeria's importance as a strategic partner in the global fight against terrorism and recognized the government's commitment to improving information sharing with us.
Like Nigerians, most citizens of Eritrea, Myanmar, and Kyrgyzstan are also barred from obtaining immigrant visas, while citizens of Sudan and Tanzania cannot participate in the diversity visa program known as the Green Card Lottery. Nigerian Foreign Minister Jeffrey Onyema said he was blindsided by the ban, but pledged to improve national security information.
We're putting in place the architecture that will now make that the information and the data on that immediately available to the U.S. and all the member states and member countries of Interpol. And we hope to have that up and running, very soon.
Onyema acknowledged his country is dealing with security threats, including terrorist group Boko Haram, which has displaced millions of Nigerians. But there is little evidence the group is a threat to Americans. The ban does not apply to citizens from impacted countries who apply for tourist visas, prompting criticisms to the administration's rationale of ensuring security.
Temporary visitors are the ones with the capacity to create the problems they are afraid of. Somebody with a fixed address in Chicago, in New York, who with a place of employment is the least disposed to creating troubles because it will be caught.
Good morning.
Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi called the ban discrimination disguised as policy, a criticism shared by Danny Bahar from the Brookings Institution.
We have here an administration that has some very strong rhetoric against migrants that are, for the most part, fueled by false evidence, false facts.
Critics argue cutting immigration ties will weaken American global influence.
Immigrants with education is an aspect of soft diplomacy. They're your friends. Or do you want to use that money to pay for the establishment of more military bases, more intelligence, more policing? It's a choice that Washington, D.C. has to make.
The amended executive order, which takes effect February 21st, will also maintain restrictions on some citizens from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, along with Venezuela and North Korea. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
The wife of Lesotho's embattled prime minister has turned herself in to face murder charges over the killing of the prime minister's estranged first wife. The saga has illuminated a wider concern in this tiny mountain kingdom surrounded by South Africa. For years, critics say the ruling party has been divided into warring factions and rule of law has been ignored. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Maseru.
After a month on the run, Lesotho's First Lady, Maisia Tebane, is in police custody, facing charges for the killing of her predecessor, former First Lady Dipolelo Tebane. The late Dipolelo Tebane was shot dead in the capital, Maseru, 2 days before Prime Minister Thomas Tebane's inauguration in 2017. At the time, the couple was in the middle of a bitter divorce, and the Prime Minister was living with Maisia. But political players in the tiny kingdom say this arrest is unlikely to fix the many problems that have long swirled around the prime minister, who announced last month that he would step down, but didn't say when. His rule has been marred with a number of killings of high-ranking officials in recent years. Critics say this is an inevitable consequence of Tebane's failure to keep the nation's security forces out of politics. Matibele Mokoto, leader of the opposition Democratic Congress, offered a suggestion to the prime minister.
They should have gone by yesterday, I think. He should resign as soon as possible. That will somehow culminate into some sort of stability, I do believe.
The Secretary General of Tebane's All-Basotho Convention, Lebohangkele, disagrees.
He did not mention time. There's no time frame for that exercise. He's intending to stand down, and he actually said he'll be waiting for his party and the coalition partners to prepare smoothly to get a smooth exit.
Mothlamelli Anthony Kappa, an associate professor in political science at the National University of Lesotho, says the real conflict in Lesotho is not between Thabane and his wives, but between Thabane and his political rival, Professor Nglosa Mahau, who's vice chancellor of the university. Mahau's brother, a top general, was killed in 2015, but no one has been charged. Mahau has pushed for the killers to be prosecuted.
There was a faction that was pro-deputy leader Professor Mahau. There was a faction also which didn't want him, which we saw later that it was supported by the prime minister, who is also the leader of the All Basotho Convention, Thomas Thabane. So you could say it is Mahau versus Thabane, probably because Thabane fears that Mahau would push for his wife to be prosecuted for having been involved in the killing of, allegedly involved in the killing of his other wife.
Kleile says he knows the matter weighs heavily on Thabane's conscience, though he says he hasn't spoken to the prime minister lately. But he disputes local headlines that say there is a crisis in Lesotho.
There's no political crisis in our country. Everything is normal. There's nothing. I mean, you are in the country. What do you see? Nothing. Everybody's going to work.
So what now for Lesotho? Crisis or no? No one can agree on a way forward. But everyone agrees that something needs to change. Anita Pal, VOA News, Maseru.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The UN's Libya envoy, Ghassan Salame, says representatives of the warring parties in Libya meeting in Geneva have agreed on the principle of turning their shaky truce into a lasting ceasefire. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, about the prospects of success while each side is putting out conditions to abide by the ceasefire.
I think there's still a long way to go before these negotiations will lead to the kind of lasting ceasefire that Hassan Salama is hoping for. The party, so there are five representatives that have been nominated by both sides. These are the people that are meeting this week. Although they have agreed in principle they would like a ceasefire, on the ground the current truce is not really holding at all. They are engaging in clashes against one another, and both sides will insist on conditions which are likely to be mutually exclusive. So on the one hand, the LNA has previously said it requires all of the militias, which many of which it terms terrorists and mercenaries, to leave Tripoli before it will agree to ceasefire terms. On the other hand, the GNA-linked forces have said that Haftar and his forces must withdraw outside of Tripoli to the positions they held prior to the conflict starting in April. Now, these two sets of conditions are miles apart, and it's going to take quite a lot for them to agree to some kind of compromise in the middle, which will mean neither side being able to say that they have kind of won or got the upper hand in the conflict.
Salama also said there is a genuine will for both parties to sit together and start negotiating together. However, so far he had separate sessions for both parties. How would that lead to a mutual commitment to a ceasefire?
And this is another key problem that neither side has yet met in person. And I think that is a real problem. It shows that the divisions and the mistrust and the suspicion between the two sides in the conflict is very deep. They can't even discuss together these conditions. So I think that is a real problem. The other thing is that there are five representatives on each side. And although on the GNA side, these are involve some of the frontline commanders, on the LNA side, although there are some high-level people there, they are not really linked with the frontline activities in Tripoli. So there is another question, which is even if they do meet together, are able to agree on some loose conditions, are they in a position to then enforce that on the ground? And will the fighters on the ground actually adhere to any terms that are agreed? And again, at the moment, that doesn't seem like that's the case.
I guess Salama is so optimistic because he said the two sides would meet for talks on economic cooperation in Cairo on February 9th and could hold political talks on resolving the conflict in Geneva in 2 weeks. Is that doable, and under what kind of circumstances?
So Salama is doing his best to create momentum based on the Berlin conference and to bring these different Libyan parties together and spark some kind of dialogue. However, I have to say, I think he is too optimistic. I think when you have to look at what is happening on the ground. And at the moment, the truce between the two sides is not holding. It hasn't completely broken in the sense that fighting is still quite muted. There are limited airstrikes, but we're seeing clashes on the front lines in Tripoli. We're seeing clashes near Misrata between the LNA and GNA forces. And more importantly, we're seeing a huge influx of arms, weaponry and mercenaries from Turkey and the UAE to both sides on the ground, which suggests that both sides are at least preparing for some sort of imminent escalation. And therefore, in those conditions, it's quite difficult to see how the kind of political dialogue, bringing the sides together outside of Libya, is actually going to change much on the ground. Now, it may be that it moves in the right direction. If there's enough international pressure, that could change something. But at the moment, we're seeing the international divisions, as well as the divisions in Libya, are still as deep as ever. And it makes it difficult to see how this is going to translate into an ending of the violence anytime soon.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. South Africa's Department of Education has advised public schools not to deny access to education to undocumented foreign children. The department says it has embarked on a campaign to inform schools to enroll these children even if they do not have documents. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The Basic Education Department says its officials are out in full force to ensure that no school acts against the High Court judgment. Elijah Mhlanga is the department spokesperson.
The DG is out. He's in the Northern Cape today. The minister as well. She will be going out on community engagement as well as the deputy minister. We go out. I'm leaving from Mpumalanga right now to do some of that work with the MECs there. So we are all seized with this matter because we understand it's a court judgment. We all need to respect it and abide by it and do exactly what it says we need to do. No school should prevent a child from accessing education because they don't have an ID book.
Last year in December, the High Court issued an order forcing all schools to enroll all learners despite their legal status. However, Anjuli Maestri, senior attorney at the Center for Child Law, says many schools continue to send away undocumented foreign children.
The law now, because of the judgment, says that they shouldn't be turned away on account of the fact that they don't have documentation. As simple as that. So the first step, we say get documentation first. But if you're unable to, you ought to be able to access some of your most basic rights, and one of those is education.
The education department says it's likely most school officials missed the judgment, as it was issued when some schools were closed for the December holiday. The latest development has been received with great joy by the migrant community. Mabuto Mabena is the chairman of the Zimbabwe community in South Africa.
I welcome the judgment by the South African courts to say every child of migrant origin should be at school even though they do not have the necessary documents. We welcome this decision and we call upon parents to ensure that their kids do attend school.
South Africa is host to thousands of undocumented children. Some have been smuggled in by parents who are themselves illegal immigrants in search of greener pastures in South Africa. Others have been born in South Africa, also by parents who entered the country illegally, making it difficult for them to obtain residency or study permits for their children. Most of these children have resorted to private schools where they are forced to pay exorbitant fees. Those whose parents cannot afford the fees stay at home. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Veterans of Zimbabwe's liberation struggle have long demanded hefty payments and benefits for their service. A bill before Parliament could reward them. Adigando gives us more on the story.
The Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Defence and Security has held public hearings on the Veterans of the Struggle Bill. One provision specifies that 20% of the land acquired by the government be reserved for war veterans. The War of Independence against the white minority regime was led by freedom fighters, whose role also entailed mobilizing and organizing the populace to support the struggle as a people's war. They were lauded as heroes. In 1997, the war vets demanded hefty compensation packages. The payouts that some received were blamed for triggering massive inflation and an economic downturn. In the 2000s, the war vets led invasions that capsized the once thriving agricultural sector. Their relationship with President Robert Mugabe soured toward the end of his reign as the group grew increasingly involved in succession politics within the ruling party. The war vets claimed they were instrumental in Mugabe's downfall in November 2017. Buster Magwizi, the spokesperson for the ZIPRA War Veterans Association, which represents the former armed wing of the ZAPU party, speaks on the genesis of the parliamentary proposal's gender stipulation.
Over the years, there has been a hurdle and a haggle to try and justify why the war veterans need pieces of land. And they had struggled to get the land until when they were principal in the running of the land repossession that took place in the country, which was very disorderly. It became a political tool for Mugabe to remain relevant in the system. Otherwise, if he had not allowed war veterans to take the land, he would have been deposed by then.
Magwizi says the 20% was Mugabe's appeasement to the war vets, but that it's inadequate.
Is 20% enough? And what are we going to do with that? So in every detail, we have always been shortchanged as war veterans with that 20% in hand. So we're saying no to that. And in terms of the new bill that we are currently debating, we need as a proposal at least 50% of the land that we can get ourselves. Wherever there are 10 people in the farm, at least 5 of them should also be veterans. As tenure for life, we need title deeds over the pieces of land that we already hold.
Observers say that position suggests a culture of entitlement by the war vets, which permeates the ruling party and creates the impunity which attends governance issues in the country. Observers also say that in post-conflict situations, there is a need to provide for equitable, sustainable assistance to veterans as part of their disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration into society. Magwizi concurs.
We needed various forms of rehabilitation, including psychological rehabilitation. Finally, we would then be resettled. We didn't get that.
Analysts say the failure to adopt a sound reintegration policy led to the war vets becoming a thorn in Mugabe's side. They clashed with him over their welfare and claims of state neglect.
An analyst,
Buso Fuzwayo, says their demands have undercut their public support.
But now it's difficult to honor them because they've stifled democracy for selfish gains. Zimbabweans are suffering. So for them to continuously be demanding personal gains at the expense of the failing economy and saying, no, what is it that the nation can do to revive the economy? And introspect, is it really what we fought for?
Zimbabwe is in the throes of a biting drought and economic downturn. Fuzwayo, however, says that the government's drought narrative concerning food insecurity comes down to politics as well.
The concept of the liberation struggle was for people to regain their land. But now the issue of land is now abused for political patronage. ZANU-PF is abusing land for loyalty. People who can farm competently at not getting the land because it is given to those who are politically correct.
Still, observers say that finalizing the war vets compensation issue is needed so that the country can move forward. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigono.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, PJ Elliott, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.